Welcome to Friday. Welcome to Week in Review. We are learning from the week's events this hour. I'm Bill Radke with my Week in Review panel, novelist, poet, screenwriter Sherman Alexie, former Washington State Republican Party chair, just ran for U.S. Senate, Chris Vance, Stranger reporter Sidney Brownstone. So glad to have you here, team. Welcome.
You bet.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Since the presidential election, KUOW has brought you all kinds of reactions from Tacoma. Gary told us this election is a victory for America's beaten down middle class.
They're losing all their jobs. They've been losing all the jobs since the 80s. They've been completely been ignored. They've been abandoned by the Clinton New Democrats. All the small towns are losing their kids. They're all going off to school and college. And they're not coming back. And so those towns are all dying. Their economies are dying. Their hospitals are closing.
So Gary is hopeful about President Trump. Chris Vance is nodding his head. Most Puget Sound voters are not so happy about it, including our panel today, unless, Chris, you've come back into the fold, as some Republicans have. You were an early repudiator of Trump.
I was. I don't know how. We had a very difficult decision to make. Well, no, it was a very easy decision to make, actually. I mean, when he became the de facto nominee, I knew that there was absolutely no way you could go through the campaign and not answer the question, who are you going to vote for?
This is your campaign against Patty Murray?
Yeah. Bill Bryant found out, no one is going to let you do that. The media, voters, no one is going to let you do that. So the second part of the equation was I wasn't supporting Donald Trump, and I couldn't lie about it. So we really had no choice. We had to come out and say, I'm not supporting Donald Trump. And in the end, I did not cast a vote for president. Like a lot of people in Washington State, one of the most fascinating things is more people are voting for the U.S. Senate and governor than voting for president. Tons of people in this state just couldn't choose and didn't vote. And so I said that early on in early May. It changed the entire arc of our campaign. But I felt like I had absolutely no choice. I mean, you had to answer the question. I couldn't lie about it.
If you preferred, so you're saying you didn't prefer Clinton to Trump as U.S. president? Because you voted for no one.
I voted for no one. Every voter has to make a personal decision when that ballot comes in the mail.
A personal decision that will, in aggregate, affect millions of people.
Right. And what I do is, if I don't know anything about the two candidates, and it's a nonpartisan race like a judge's race, or if I believe that my party has nominated someone who just isn't qualified, and that's happened before for other offices, I just leave it blank. I couldn't vote affirmatively for Hillary Clinton.
Why not?
I don't agree with her on the issues, on the core issues.
But did you prefer her as a candidate?
I'm not going to answer that question.
Okay.
If somebody had forced me to cast a vote, I'm not going to do that. And I didn't agree with Donald Trump on the issues. And one of the more frustrating things was everyone just immediately assumed it was because of his hair or his demeanor or the things he said. And yeah, I don't think he's qualified. I don't think he has the temperament to be president. But it was much more substantive than that. I mean, I'm a Reagan Republican, and I haven't changed my philosophy or what I believe. He's not. On trade, on the economy, on entitlement reform, on national defense, on immigration, he's 180 degrees opposite of where my party has been for the past 30, 40 years. I couldn't vote for that just because he had an R after his name.
Okay. We are going to talk this hour about what to do about all these opinions. So what about you, Sherman Alexie? What are you doing, if anything, about politics?
Well, it's concrete action. The thing that's most threatened right now is independent journalism. He's avoiding press pools. He's avoiding standards that presidents have set for generations about their interactions with the free press. So one of the things I've done is resubscribed and newly subscribed to, at least 40 magazines and news sites, websites that do independent journalism. So that's one thing I did. I donated money to 30
subscribing online?
Donating money to online journals and then actually subscribing to magazines. So I'm going to have a mailbox full. My mail person is going to know that, a commie bastard lives at my address by all the magazines I'm getting. But I'm also subscribing to middle of the road magazines as well that are not leftist, but are moderate, because it's going to take a moderate leftist coalition, including Republicans like Chris, to actually stop Trump. I was teasing Chris in the lobby about, you're going to have to be marching with us tie-dye people It's, you know, I tease my Republican friends.
Republicans don't know how to protest.
We're going to have to teach you how to chant, how to do stupid, repetitious, memorable chants. There's going to be a lot of Republicans doing really stupid, bad poetry in the streets of the United States, along with us tie-dye people.
This is what poetry looks like. We're here, we're Republican, we're not sure whether everything has to rhyme, get used to it.
We're here, we're Republican, we're moderately okay with queer.
Right. Sidney Brownstone, do you agree that Sherman, among other things, just said it's going to take moderates? That's what we need. Do you agree with that?
I think it's going to take a variety of people. I think that the most important thing I can do as a journalist and a leftist is to allow people younger than I am to speak, and allow people who are going to more directly face the impacts of Trump's administration to speak about their fears and their anger. I'm glad Sherman said what he said about independent journalism. I think the most important thing I can do right now is keep my job and be vigilant about rhetoric, because I think the biggest danger of his presidency in this election is normalizing racism, sexism, misogyny, Islamophobia, which we've already seen to some degree. It's already happening.
So do you think we needed less moderation and more in the media? Do you feel like in general the mainstream media normalized whatever Trump did and we needed more opinionation?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I'm already the type of journalist who doesn't subscribe to the idea of objectivity. I think that whatever we call objectivity is usually white male objectivity. So I'm a human being. I'm a woman. I'm a Jewish person. I'm a young person, I'm a millennial, I lean left. I'm very clear about those things. And I think that we need to be upfront with our perspective and give readers, you know, the truth. I think there's a danger of false equivalency. And I think that a lot of journalists treated Trump like a joke at first. And then when his campaign became more and more serious, we just reverted to he said, she said journalism. Trump said this without noting how far that is from what's been the political mainstream for years. That being said, Trump has been in the making by the Republican Party for at least the last 30 years. And I think that his brand of, or the brand of people who elected him, their brand of white supremacy and patriarchy is coded in our country's DNA. That's not a surprise. But I think that we can't allow the people he's appointing to come to power. I think that's a very dangerous proposition.
Chris Vance, any disagreement?
Yes. There's a lot of people believe, I hear this all the time, that Trump's been in the making in the Republican Party for a very long time. The way I view it is there has always been a dark side. There's a dark wing to American conservatism, and it's always been there. Going all the way back to the Know-Nothings in the 1850s, to all sorts of isolationist, anti-immigrant, racial overtones. I look at a lot the John Birch Society in the 1950s and 60s, which sends – you look at Bircher propaganda. It's exactly what the Trump campaign was saying. We're losing our culture. We got to keep out immigrants. There's this big vast – the conspiracy thing, the whole thing with the alt-right and InfoWars and Alex Jones and the National Enquirer and all this. That's always been out there. The difference is they've always been there, but they've always lost. The Reagan wing of our party always won. Pat Buchanan never became the nominee. Dan Evans disavowed the John Birch Society. Ronald Reagan disavowed the John Birch Society. This was the year for the first time in my living memory that that wing of my party won, and now they govern. So in a way, I guess it's always been there. But
you're distancing Republicans from this, you call it the dark wing?
No, they've been part of the Republican coalition,
okay.
But they've never been in the majority. They were never able to nominate someone for president. Pat Buchanan's the best example. He ran twice for president, and he lost. If you listen carefully, Pat Buchanan and Donald Trump are saying the exact same things. What happened in 2016 is they actually won, and they found a governing coalition out there by getting all of the working class, non-college educated white voters to come vote for them. And now they won.
They got all the white people.
No, that's not true.
The majority of white people in the country voted for Donald Trump, yeah. Across, you know, millennials, I think, were the only white folks who went for Clinton.
No, college-educated white voters.
And went women and men. That's the thing. What I'm seeing now is white people blaming each other all across the board for Trump, blaming other people. But the thing is, Trump's election is the fault of every white person in the country, from Mitt Romney on the right to Jill Stein on the left. So this election is the fault of about, 70% of white people.
Why does that matter?
Because they didn't do enough. They weren't serious enough. My Republican friends that I referenced, they were vehemently against Trump from the very beginning, like Chris was, like Liz Mayer was, like Anna Navarro was, like Amanda Carpenter was, these never-Trumpers. But they also equivocated. They left their voting blank, which is a moral equivocation, Chris.
No, I don't.
It is.
Don't,
it's a moral equivocation.
I don't agree with that.
It's like leaving the, Hitler's running. I'm going to leave it blank. And and they
just
did,
to note, we got to Hitler at 17 minutes past the hour.
And the thing is, he's not Hitler. I shouldn't have said that. It was Mussolini.
You can say it.
Mussolini. He's the Spanish guy. Blanked on his name. The dictator.
Franco.
He's Franco. But the thing is, they never went public. In a big way, they continued to demonize Clinton and continue to compare her to Trump as if their faults with her, their disagreements with her, were on a moral level with their disagreements with Trump. Whatever you want to say about Clinton, and you can say a lot of things about her if you're a Republican, she is not Trump, has never been Trump. There's never been any evidence in 35 years of continual investigation that is true. That actually points to anything they did that was illegal. Sleazy, maybe, but there's nothing illegal. And the thing is, my Republican friends and the Republicans I know continue to demonize Clinton. And the far left, the Jill Steiners, continue to demonize Clinton. And this demonization of Clinton by this wide swath of anti-Trumpers contributed to this loss.
There is. I remember we were talking about a Republican civil war a couple of weeks ago. There's a left fight. Shama Sawant, city council member, was one of those people who essentially said, Trump, Clinton, it's all the same. And she's getting some pushback now on the left from people saying, because she's calling for some kind of national, protests on Inauguration Day. And some people are saying, including I saw in The Stranger, Sydney, saying that she should put down the bullhorn.
Yeah, I mean, I think Shama Sawant made the mistake that a lot of people on the left made, which was to assume that this was a safe election and that it's okay to vote for a third-party candidate. It was never okay to vote for a third-party candidate when there's a candidate who's been endorsed by the KKK, who's one of the presidential nominees. It's nuanced because she's receiving a lot of hate from a lot of different folks. She's gotten hate from Trump supporters. She's gotten hate from leftists who say that she shouldn't have advocated for Jill Stein. I want to put that aside. I think that change is not going to come from Shama Sawant nationally. I don't think it's going to come from Socialist Alternative. I think it's going to come from people doing community organizing, which is not really something that Socialist Alternative does. I think it's going to come from people developing young leaders in the community and allowing them to speak.
Okay, let's pause for a moment. We're going to keep talking. There's so many different ways we can talk about what to do about this election, whether you like it or not. So we're going to pick up on some of that in just a moment on KUOW's Week in Review. Chris Vance, Sydney Brownstone, Sherman Alexie, right back. On KUOW's Week in Review, The Stranger, Sydney Brownstone, former state Republican chair Chris Vance, novelist, screenwriter, poet Sherman Alexie, talking about what to do about this election, however you feel about it. Some people, what they've been doing is protesting. A protest in Portland most famously devolved into bottle throwing at police and dozens of arrests. There have been many more vocal and peaceful marches, including in Seattle. Republican Chris Vance, any problem with that approach? Protest.
Well, it depends what you're trying to accomplish. If you're trying to change the arc of American politics, going out in the street and confirming to Trump voters everything they already believe about the left is not going to do it. It just hardens the attitudes of, again, these working class, non-college educated white voters who are super patriotic, and they think that protesting is not.
What's your evidence for that? You've been campaigning around the state. Is that what you hear?
Absolutely.
You know more about Red America than some of us.
Oh, absolutely. And look, most of this happened in the Great Lakes, but there's an example of it here in Washington State, where not only Trump but all Republicans got historically high vote totals in that crescent of counties that rings the ocean. The Grays Harbor, Pacific, Wakayakum, Cowlitz,
Mason,
where Republicans have never won before. We've just won a state legislative seat. These are towns that, just like we just heard at the opening, their hospitals are closing, their churches are closing. People there used to cut down trees and catch fish for a living, and now they can't do that. And they are very angry, but they love America. You go there and there's flags in their front yards, and they think that people protesting in the streets of downtown Seattle is terrible. And you're not going to get them to vote for Democrats by doing that. Sorry, I'm a politician. If you want to win, if you want to go out and have fun and protest, great. But it's not going to help to win.
Sydney, you buy that?
No, not at all. I think that the biggest danger in the coming months, the coming years, is indifference. And I think that we should be scared. We should be angry. And protesting is a perfectly valid form of expressing that anger and expressing that fear.
Chris is saying it's valid, but it doesn't help your cause.
Right. I want to be really clear about that. I'm not saying anybody should lose the right to protest. I don't support Doug Erickson's bill to criminalize people who protest. I'm just saying, if you want to engage in smart politics, it doesn't help.
Here's what's smart politics to me. Last week, thousands of high school students walked out of class. These are kids who are going to face the worst impacts of climate change of anyone living in the world today. And they spoke in solidarity with their Muslim peers. They spoke in solidarity with their Black peers, with their queer peers, with their female classmates. And it was the most inspiring thing that I had experienced after 2 weeks of very, very depressing conversations with adults. And I think it's so important to hear those voices. I think it's so important to hear the voices of people who are marginalized and whose futures are on the line. And I think that's the power of protest. That's the power.
Sherman Sydney says she was inspired. Chris is saying, yeah, but you are uninspiring a whole bunch of people and it's not helping you. What's your take?
Well, I probably know more about Red State America than most of the Republicans who are serving in office right now. I grew up in Red State America. I was president of my high school's chapter, The Future Farmers of America. I was prom.
How's farming going?
I was prom king in Lincoln County, which is the whitest, most conservative county in the state. I was prom king at my high school in that county. So I know white people love me. Right wing Christian white people love me. I slept with their daughters. The thing is, protests lead to
energy. Sydney Brownstone just gave us a spit take. That was
yeah.
Classic.
So protests lead to boycotts, lead to pressure on legislation, lead to court cases, lead to law. It's a natural progression in American history. I mean, the United States doesn't exist without protests. The formation of the United States was a protest. Mm. So all of that is awesome. But the thing is, until he's president, they're not going to change the fact that he's president. That's my issue right now, is there's a lot of energy going on, but it feels like people think we're in a sprint, and we're not. We're in a marathon. So I'm afraid that this energy that's happening right now is going to dissipate. So as we're doing these protests, we need to organize boycotts, which are highly organized, effective protests or boycotts.
Who would you boycott?
One of the things going on right now is all the people associated with Trump products. We have a president who is publicly and blatantly going to be using the office to make money. And so we have to make sure that that is continually remarked on, and that we have to boycott those businesses that are going to allow the president of the United States to profit off the office. Nordstrom's, locally.
Do you risk diverting attention to something that is small bore compared to bigger issues?
Nothing is small bore, because this is one part of the effort. This is one part of the effort. And the thing is, this goes back to an old joke, an onstage joke that I've told for 25 years about liberals. Is that, you know, we have to stop protesting for ourselves, for our own rights. I mean, that's one of the reasons why white Republicans are so powerful, is that they organize around one theme, you know, white Republicans. And what my joke is that we always needed to have a liberal protest giving tree, that for every year you had to pull off a card off the tree, and that you couldn't pull off your own group. Mm. You had to pull off a card off the tree, and then for the next year, you had to protest and be politically active for that oppressed group. So you might have like leftist vegan Jill Stein voters for Iowa corn farmers, so that you weren't. That your protests didn't become narcissistic, that your protests were about the country as a whole, and your protests were about a group that may or may not be represented. And certainly there was a lot of valid discontent among working class white folks. And certainly the Clinton campaign did not even come close to addressing that. But it's up to us now as liberals, as people who believe in income inequality, who believe in helping the lesser, that we have to include them in our formulations. Does that mean we have to condone the racism? Of course not. But the thing is, growing up as a Native American in an extremely conservative Eastern Washington, what I found is that racist Republicans are experts at compartmentalizing their racism. Mm. I was acceptable as an individual, a Native American individual, regardless of the fact that I've always been a commie lefty. But the thing is, while accepting me as an individual, they were completely capable of demonizing the entire race. So what we do is we bombard these areas with individuals. So yes, I think these protests should move into Cowlitz County. And I think these protesters should be protesting the fact that this Trump government is going to screw his voters just as much as he's going to screw the rest of us. The jobs are not coming back, and he's lying. He's lying, he's lying, and he knows he's lying. These jobs are not coming back.
And that's where Sherman is making a good point, the only good point I liked in that. But good luck with protesting in Cowlitz County. If the jobs don't come back.
Is that a threat?
No, just saying if the jobs don't come back, then these voters will hold Mr. Trump accountable. But don't be so quick. Let me just one example. The only reason we are not digging for coal today and burning coal is because Barack Obama issued an executive order making that almost impossible.
That's not true. Coal is a global commodity.
Donald Trump,
the market is suffering, and it's not because of Obama.
Donald Trump will lift that immediately. He can allow, for instance, oil drilling in offshore areas. He can do a lot of things that are going to make a difference in these communities anybody else may not agree with. But don't be so quick to assume he can't actually reverse some liberal policies that have prevented economic growth in these areas. The Democratic Party has tried to hold together this blue-green coalition, and it's already been fraying. And a Trump administration is not going to worry so much about the green side of this. They're going to do everything they can to maximize blue-collar jobs to try and keep these promises, and they might.
The Republican Party, what you're hearing right now is the Republican Party trying to sell an economic ideology that is demonstrably false and hasn't worked, and that's trickle-down economics. And it didn't start with Reagan. You know, it started with white slave owners in the South telling poor whites that they were better than African slaves. And that's how you created a hierarchy of class and people who were willing to vote for you despite voting against their own economic best interests. And I think that in order to dismantle that, it's not just going to require protesting. It's not just going to require journalists like me writing articles. I don't think that voters are going to hold Trump accountable for not bringing jobs back, because I think that what this election demonstrated is that we live in kind of like this post-fact world where it doesn't matter what the truth is, as long as you're tapping into someone's emotional truth. And I think that it's going to require a massive cultural shift. I'm not quite sure how we get there. I think it happens in bits and pieces. I think everyone does what they can, and different people with different amounts of social privilege do what I can. I think it's very important for people like Chris Vance to talk to his fellow Republicans. I think it's very important for him to get out there and talk to people who wouldn't be willing to speak with me or take me seriously because of my cultural background or my gender. And I think that on the left, I have to also hold people accountable. I have to hold the white men in charge of our institutions, our liberal institutions, accountable. That's where it starts.
I think that, again, I think that's the idea of it post-truth. Christian Sinderman and I did a forum the other night at the Evans School to talk about this. Christian's maybe, I think, one of the smartest Democrat consultants out there. And he grew up in a small industrial town in Michigan, and he talked about truth. And he said, look, you got to understand, You got people there who made $9.75 at Walmart. Their father made $20 an hour working at the tool and die factory. Their grandfather made $40 an hour working for Packard. That's their truth, is three generations of downward mobility. And they're sick of it. And they're sick of having Democrats say they're going to fix it for them with a little bit of community college training. Donald Trump came in and said, I'm going to open the steel mill. I'm going to bring the jobs back. Now, maybe he can't. But that is their truth. And what's going to matter to them is, do their lives get better or not? Because right now, their lives are terrible. These people out on the coast who used to be able to walk into a lumber mill and make a good, high-paying union job, they're not accepting the idea that they have to work at a Costco. They want the mill reopened.
This is what the GOP chair in Grays Harbor County told me, is that we voted for Obama twice. That was emotional truth, and our lives haven't improved. And again, whether we disagree or not, that was his take, was kind of echoing what Chris is saying. Now, whether jobs will come back and whether they'll flip back to the Democrat
right.
in 4 years, we don't know. But we're gonna take a pause. I just want to make sure, because we have so much more to talk about. But Chris, you were down on protests. We heard boycott. We heard some other to-dos. Then if not protest, that, because you were a Trump repudiator, if not protest, then what?
Win
only one thing.
Win elections.
So organize.
Win elections. That's how you change public policy in America, is you win the election. That's the only way you change public policy.
And one thing to do to win elections?
I don't need to give...
Get the popular vote?
I don't need to give advice.
That didn't work.
I don't need to give advice to Democrats, but they've got to come up with policies that will bring jobs back to small-town, rural, blue-collar America, or they're never going to get these voters back.
Okay, let's talk about Electoral College and some other things when we come back on KUOW's Week in Review. Sherman Alexie, Chris Vance, Sidney Brownstone. On KUOW's Week in Review, I'm Bill Radke, talking with Chris Vance, Sidney Brownstone, Sherman Alexie about what to do with Donald Trump, like him or not. And we just brought up the Electoral College. We talked with a Washington State elector this week. He's one of the Electoral College members. He's a Democrat. He's lobbying to get Republican electors to vote for anyone but Trump, keep Trump under the 270-vote threshold. That throws the election to the U.S. House, where theoretically they might pick Mitt Romney or someone. Now, he's saying this is a long shot. It's a Hail Mary. It's not going to happen. But does anyone think that is, quote unquote, not refusing to accept the results of the election? Is that undemocratic? Is that something that the left accused the right of doing when Donald Trump was poo-pooing the Electoral College?
Yes. Yes. I mean, we have elections in this country, and we have a system that includes the Electoral College, which I don't support. I would vote for a constitutional amendment tomorrow to get rid of the Electoral College. But it is the system we have. You got to play by the rules. He won the election. I mean, the democracy is based on being a good loser. You lose the election, you shake the guy's hand, and you go on. And that's how it has to work.
Sherman, agreed?
On many of these issues, I try, and I often fail, but I try to think of how would the opposite party react to this situation, and how would we react to their reaction. If the reverse was true, if Trump had won the popular vote and Clinton had won the Electoral College, the right would be doing the same thing. And then we left would be saying the things that the right are saying about us now.
So we're all hypocrites. Where does that get us?
What it gets us to is that we need to go out now and start getting people the voter IDs that allow them to vote in their state. We can agree that a lot of these voter ID laws are racist and archaic, but the action, the response to that, is to create concentrated national state-by-state efforts to get proper ID into the hands of voters. And I try to say this now. I tried to say this last night to a woman at my performance, and she kept going off on these tangents about the unfairness of voter rights laws, about the history of racism. She was very smart, very educated. She was bringing up all these cases. And I kept saying, no, get out of the clouds. Get out of the liberal ether and come down to the basic fact of that we need more IDs in the hands of more voters.
Yeah, I agree with Sherman, and voter suppression was one of the major factors in this election. When it comes to the Electoral College, I agree with Chris. I don't like the Electoral College. I would change it tomorrow if I could. Here's my fear. So the Nazi Party came to power democratically. They won a plurality in the German parliamentary structure at the time. So fascism can arise out of democracy. I'm scared on the one hand of that. On the other hand, there's a part of the left that is calling for revolution and saying, yes, like, let's get the electors to change their minds. Let's have chaos in the streets. Let's have it all change tomorrow. None of these people have actually lived through a revolution. And I'm not sure that their families who are lived through revolution either. Revolution is not pretty. Revolution is very bloody. And I'm not a revolutionary socialist. That's not something that I would like to see. So as you know, disheartening and scary as our democracy is right now, I think we have to work with the structure that we have.
Okay, we brought up fascism twice now, so let's talk about that. Just for one example, Trump's choice for his White House strategist, his Karl Rove, his John Podesta, is Steve Bannon, who called his website, the Breitbart website, the platform for the alt-right. Chris Vance, if you had defeated Senator Patty Murray, you were in Congress, what would you do about Steve Bannon? What's the threat level? Would you denounce him? What good would denouncing do?
Yeah, I would denounce him and that entire wing of the party. It probably wouldn't do any good. If I'd have won the election, I don't think Donald Trump would be taking my phone calls right now. But I do want to talk about that for a minute. Again, this is what I said earlier. There has always been a wing of our party that is really interested in culture. And it's so – you have to be really careful, I think, about calling your fellow Americans racists. To me, a racist is someone who rejects human beings entirely because of their race. If the Republican Party was systemically racist, you wouldn't have black Americans running for office as Republicans. Darrell Glenn in Colorado, African American, nearly was elected to the U.S. Senate as a Republican. The Republicans are fine with Hispanics and black Americans and women if you're a conservative. I don't think they're motivated entirely by racism, pure racism. But there is this idea out there that I hear consistently from that wing of the party that American culture is under assault. And when you go around this country, there's lots of different cultures. And any human being, I think, feels threatened when they begin to lose their culture, when their language is no longer spoken, when the restaurants they're used to are no longer there. Seattle Times did a big story about how the central area is gentrifying and the African-American culture is lessening in that part of Seattle. And the folks who live there don't like it. Well, I heard consistently during the campaign from older white Americans who said, this doesn't feel like my country anymore. And I never pushed him on that because I didn't want the answer of exactly what they meant. But Steve Bannon and Breitbart and the alt-right, they represent that wing of the party that believe that traditional white Anglo-Saxon American culture is under siege. I hate that. I hate when culture is mixed with politics. But they are absolutely a threat. Now, final word on this is you can be worried about losing your culture. I don't know how you enact public policy to change that. It'll be interesting to see how they govern. I mean, what law are you going to pass that is going to effectuate the Breitbart agenda? They just like to rant about conspiracy theories. But yes, I'm very concerned about that wing of our party. But
that's the question, isn't it? Wait and see, and maybe it's all talk.
I'll take a Western Civ quiz head-to-head against anybody in Trump's administration, and I'll kick their ass. The fact is, this has nothing to do with European culture. This has nothing to do with Western civilization. This has to do with 8 years of an African-American president. This has everything to do with a moderate, liberal African-American president being vilified over and over and over again. We have elected the man who constantly questioned his birth. That is racist. That is racist, questioning his birth. So it's another dodge. You're dodging, Chris. You're dodging the issues.
No, I'm not dodging.
You're dodging.
I don't agree with you, and
you speaking earlier about economics. Mm-hmm. What I see now is moderate Republicans preparing themselves to accept Trump based purely on money and taxes. And it's the Tennessee Ernie Ford dodge. I just coined a term for it. Because what they're talking about is the same old economic system that exploits these people in the same way. You know, it's the you load 16 tons and what do you get? A little bit older and deeper in debt. So it's not some revolution on their side. It's a return to the same economic policies that have oppressed the same people for generations. That's what they're calling for.
No, and I
return
I do
to that same
this
system.
As a dodge in any way. And look, a couple things. First of all, Republicans hated Bill Clinton, a white male Southerner, as much if not more than they hated Barack Obama. Republicans hate Democrats. They don't. It's not because of race. But you're right about the birther thing and all the crazy conspiracy theories is part of this dark wing of our party, the alt-right, that has never been ascendant, never been the majority in our party, but is right now. But to just say all Republicans oppose Barack Obama because he was African-American is just completely wrong. And it contributes to, again, how – and I say this with all due respect. I was born here. I served on the King County Council. I'm not from the – I love Seattle. But Seattle is so pitifully out of step with the rest of the state and the rest of the country. You guys have no idea what's going on outside the boundaries of the city of Seattle. None.
I know more than you do, Chris Vance.
Okay, well, let's then. This
95% of my family and friends live outside of Seattle, and they live in this state, and I've lived here for about 48,000 years.
This is another important thread of the conversation is the idea of getting out of your bubble. Your Facebook bubble, your Seattle bubble, your Thanksgiving bubble. Let's talk about people getting along in just a moment. We'll take a quick. This is a good time to take a quick break and right back with Sidney Brownstone, Sherman Alexie, Chris Vance on the Week in Review. On KUOW's Week in Review, we're talking about what to do about President Trump and the Republican Congress, like them or not. Sherman Alexie, Sidney Brownstone, and Chris Vance with you. Next question, what do we do about Facebook? This week, founders Mark Zuckerberg scoffed at charges that Facebook helped elect Donald Trump by allowing fake news on the site. Some Facebook employees disagree. They think it hurt Clinton and helped Trump that users saw fake reports that the Pope endorsed Trump and Clinton sold weapons to ISIS. And still other people say the big megillah here is not fake news. It's just Facebook bias. Which has a lot. It has to do with human bias. Let's work this out, Sidney Brownstone.
Yeah. Well, I think it's ludicrous that Facebook isn't taking responsibility for its role in this election. I absolutely think it was a factor. Here's what's been happening over the last several years. Instead of going to websites like the New York Times homepage to get news, people have just been looking on their Facebook feeds, and Facebook is very well aware of this. It subscribes to a profit-making model in which it tries to customize each person's experience and individualize it. So it's actually driven by profit to create bubbles. Now, there's a problem inherent in this model because journalism is a public service. It's supposed to be the fourth estate. We're supposed to be informing the public. If you're living in this online universe where you're only surrounded by positive affirmations of your pre-existing beliefs, that's you don't get information. You don't get usable information. Also, Facebook refused to crack down on fake news sites when it was brought up within the organization. So not only is there a problem inherent in their model, they also refused to correct it. Anyway, I think that in this new era, we're all citizens of online nation states. Facebook is one of them. Twitter is another. But we have no power to control how they function. And they determine so much of our physical reality on the ground. This election may go down in history as the first election that was determined by these online nation states. And I think that we absolutely have to hold our technocrats accountable. They are controlling power structures in our world as well.
So what's one thing a listener can do to hold them accountable?
Well, first of all, you might want to boycott Facebook, although I say that and I realize how impossible that sounds. I think that the thing that you do is something that's
impossible to me. I barely use it.
Yeah, I mean, I use Facebook for my job, unfortunately. But I think you subscribe to independent journalism. You pay for good journalism. You pay for good information. Maybe that means even subscribing to journalists' individual GoFundMes. Find people who are responsible in your community, who are doing the work, and support them.
Anybody disagree? Got a better idea?
No. And Facebook has become an unbelievably powerful political tool. But I go back to, I just think there's a lot of self-reinforcing bias there. The people who read these fake newspaper sites, these news sites at Facebook, They read it and stuff because they already believe it. I just think there's an enormous amount of denial out there. And it happens whenever you lose an election. You want to blame somebody. It's like when your sports team loses, it's all because somebody did or didn't call a pass interference penalty. The left wants to blame Donald Trump on all these other things rather than confronting the real problem, which is they have lost the loyalty and support of white working class Americans. That's the real issue here. Not Facebook has got some problems, but that's not what gave us Donald Trump.
Well, to underline the concern about Facebook beyond fake news is that Facebook feeds you what you want, and they're popular. This is the argument. They're popular precisely because of that. That human beings are not rational. That's not what our brains are for. Our brains are there to perpetuate the species, and we've evolved with the piece of meat in our skulls that we have, and we rationalize, and we catastrophize, and we leap to conclusions, and we, above all, we love to hear how right we are and how good our tribe is, and what do you do with that?
I mean, as a leftist on the internet, I get bombarded with just as much false liberal news as I did with false conservative news. Yep. The problem is not necessarily the political bias of the internet, but the internet itself. I think it makes all of us operate with our alligator brains.
Alligator, there you go.
And I am certainly, in the aftermath of the election, I am seriously reevaluating my relationship to the internet. I've always been suspicious of it. I've always been less of a user than most of the people in my life. I only have a professional Facebook page, and I tweet, and I don't interact with anybody. It seems to me that the worst impulses of all of us become our sole means of communicating on the internet. So that's one of the reasons why I'm subscribing to more paper journals. I think it's funny to say these kind of things, but I think there's actually a call for the calmness of paper, of actual paper. I think the return to actual physical object in your hands is something amazing. Yes.
Sherman, I love your idealism, but as a journalist, a lot of my work goes up online, and I think that's just the reality that we're living in. I think that, you know, the internet can be a powerful tool for good if we are able to actually influence the people who control it. And there's no accountability there. That's the problem. And I don't think journalism was ever meant to be a capitalist enterprise, and something that Facebook has reinforced, and it's turned it almost solely into a capitalist, a profit-seeking machine. And that's the problem with it.
One thing people say when they're saying get out of your Facebook bubble, they'll say we should right now more than ever establish a dialogue with people who disagree with us. Do you accept that? That we should understand, we should empathize, we should reach
yes.
across. Does everyone agree?
Yeah, well, yes. And again, and I'm sitting here giving advice to Democrats, and maybe I shouldn't do that. I'd almost rather talk about the issues in my party, because there are major issues in the Washington State Republican Party. But Democrats, urban Democrats, have got to take seriously and not belittle why people who had been Democrats for decades in Democrat communities suddenly voted for Donald Trump. And if they don't, if they keep blaming Facebook and blaming racism, they're not going to win these people back.
But does meeting Trump supporters, how do you know that's going to help anybody?
I don't know, but I do remember when I was in the King County Council, my good friend Louise Miller demanded that we all actually get in a bus and go out into rural King County. And there was one member of the county council who I won't name, who's a Seattle Democrat, said, "Are we still in King County?" Because he'd never been past 405.
Don't you just fall off the world when you go past that?
Sherman is from Lincoln County.
There's dragons out there.
But people need to go to Cathlamet and go to Grays Harbor and figure and see what's happening there. And take it seriously and say, okay, we need to do something about this, not just tell them all to move to Seattle and go to work for Amazon.
And that's what I want to clarify earlier. My protests weren't about us protesting liberal causes in those other counties. My protests were for us to go out there and protest for the people in that county.
They don't want
for
to their protest causes. For them. They want the mill reopened.
And we can do what we can. That's what I mean, to address their concerns about the mill. Or barring that, why shouldn't national Democrats start lying, as Trump did, about the jobs that are not coming back? But or run John Stewart and Neil deGrasse Tyson in 2020. the fact is also, we keep talking about that some major revolution happened and it didn't. Clinton's going to win the popular vote by a larger margin than Kennedy won.
Oh, I so disagree.
And you
lost Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan.
By the fact is, you know, I did the math last night. If approximately 150,000 Jill Stein voters had voted for Clinton, she would be president right now across these swing states. And so there's all sorts of – and the thing is, I'm not saying that's the cause. I'm saying there's all these small factors that contributed to this. But there hasn't been some massive change in the country.
I disagree.
And in terms of voting patterns, there was not a massive change.
That's just not true.
You can talk about tiny percentages in a lot of places that changed it. And the thing is, those can easily be changed back.
But that's
what we agree on this. To get them back is a small series of actions that the Democrats need to take to get back those voters, because we're talking about 250,000 people whose minds we need to change. And we need to do the combination of things that Chris is talking about and the things I'm talking about to get those 250,000 people away from Trump.
Yeah, on extending empathy to people on the other side of the political aisle, I mostly agree with what's been said here with one caveat, and that is not everyone can reach out to people in those rural counties with the same level of safety, just bodily safety. I have a friend, Ayman Ismail. He's an incredible journalist and photographer, videographer. He has gone on CNN multiple times. He's a Muslim American. He grew up in Newark. His family is Egyptian, and talked about the hate that he's gotten in the streets. And I mean, people have physically assaulted him. And every time he goes on CNN, he is introducing millions of viewers to his name and his face and his skin color, and he's doing that at great personal risk. And I respect him so much, but I would never ask someone in his position to go out and do that, because everyone has to make those individual decisions for themselves. This is why I think it's so important that at this moment we show up for one another's battles and we leverage our privilege. This is why it's important for people like me and Chris. I got to talk to my white women, you know. Chris has to talk to his white men. We have to do the work within our own social levels to change minds. And I wouldn't blame anyone who faces real physical harm from not doing that.
On the national level, in the public figure brown people world that I'm a part of, the death threats have exponentially risen since last Tuesday, to the point where safety is being talked about, and that we are radically threatened in a way we have never been before.
What about interpersonal level? The obvious symbol coming up is Thanksgiving, right? We're like, are you going to finally engage Uncle Fester at at the dinner table? Do you want to? We've heard, just listen, ask questions. Don't try to prove the other person wrong. Understand. Does everyone buy that?
Well, I'm lucky. I married into a family of Irish Catholic Democrats from Boston. I don't think there's anybody in my family that voted for Donald Trump. So I don't have that problem. That's all very interesting to me. But I'm not a very touchy-feely person. I'm Norwegian, kind of emotionless.
Uh-huh.
And that sort of stuff is great, but it's not going to change public policy. I mean, and what I'm worried about right now, we spent a lot of the conversation here talking about how to help the Democrats. I'm worried about my party. I'm worried about my brand. I'm worried about the future of moderate Reagan-type Republicans who believe in free trade and want to bring down the debt and are concerned about our alliances around the world. That agenda, no one's talking about that right now.
Your party is talking about forming a registry for Muslims. There are more important things to focus on.
No one's
on
actually
right now
talking about that. But it's not my party that's talking about that. Because I don't belong to that party.
Are you leaving the Republican Party? This is your chance.
Let's see. One thing. This is throughout the campaign. The Trump supporters said to me, "Chris, he doesn't mean it. He's not going to actually do that stuff." So let's see what he does. Let's see what he actually does. If he governs as he campaigned, then I don't think Reaganism and Trumpism are irreconcilable. And if he governs as he campaigned, I think a lot of Reagan-type Republicans will be leaving. But that is months from now.
Any other final words?
We'll see when he announces the anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant policies. If he follows through, I am certainly hoping, as Chris is hoping, that a huge percentage of moderate Republicans and conservatives turn their back on him, who actively join the efforts against him. That's what it's going to require. It's going to take a revolution. The funny thing is, as we talk about revolutions as leftists, to actually combat Trump, if he becomes who we fear he's going to be, it's actually going to take radical revolution inside the Republican Party to actually stop Trump. And radical revolution inside the Republican Party might be one of the greater oxymorons of all time. So we'll see. I don't know.
Sydney Brownstone, last word.
Can that be the last word? I think it's too dangerous to wait and see and not take Trump at his word right now. And I encourage every expression of anger and frustration and fear as long as it's not violent.
We started this hour by hearing from a Trump supporter. We've heard from many on KUOW and NPR. Our panel this hour has been stocked with non-Trump supporters, Republican Chris Vance, former state Republican Party chair, and former King County Council member as well, Stranger reporter Sydney Brownstone, poet, novelist, filmmaker Sherman Alexie. And we have an idea, speaking of Thanksgiving. Come, if you're one of these people who has a beef, maybe turkey is the better metaphor, and you've just sublimated it with Uncle Fester, come to KUOW and hash it out on the radio. Bring your family member to our studio. We're doing this. Talk through your difference. Not live. We'll record it. Talk about your disagreement, and then I'll interview you about how you all felt about that. You might inspire somebody to make a breakthrough at Thanksgiving.
Let's all come together on the holiday that commemorates the objectification and subjectification of Native Americans and talk about peace and love.
Yeah, what are you talking about this Thanksgiving, Sherman?
Let's all get around this genocidal turkey and talk about getting back together as a country.
Fair enough. Yeah. I deserve that.
What's going to be fascinating is I'm waiting to see who he picks for Secretary of State. That will be a very interesting moment. There's a whole bunch of names out there, including Mitt Romney, of all people. So we'll see.
Okay, we'll see. If you want to get in on the family chat, you want to do that in our studio, send an email to us, record@kuow.org, record@kuow.org. And you can practice right now, because as I speak, some of my KOW colleagues are at Solstice Cafe in the U District until 3 o'clock this afternoon. They've set up a little mock Thanksgiving table out front, and they're giving people a chance to sit and talk through that uncomfortable issue in a safe space, at least a place where Uncle Fester can't mansplain you to death. So join us down at Solstice Cafe, and thanks for tuning in. And thank you, Sydney, Sherman, Chris. Thanks for this.
Thank you.
I'm Bill Radke. Join us on Twitter. We're there at KUOW. Thanks for tuning in.